listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
Hello, everyone. This is author Cal Wilson. Welcome to another episode of the Survival in Motion podcast. On today's episode, what I'm going to do is have an interview with Aaron Frankel, who is the podcaster over at In the Rabbit Hole podcast that can be found at intherabbithole.com. A few weeks ago, he published an episode entitled WTF, and it had the bad news that he had decided to stop producing new episodes of In the Rabbit Hole podcast. And I was kind of bummed to hear that because I, you know, as I think I've told you before, I listen to other survivalist podcasts out there, and In the Rabbit Hole is one of them I really like. Anyway, in his WTF episode and explanation, he went into some of the details and some of the reasons why he decided to stop producing In the Rabbit Hole podcasts, among which were the passing of his father. Sounds like right after his father retired. And also the fact that he had to put down his dog. And I'm sympathetic to both of those, but I'm also a dog person. So I totally understand how those two events can kind of startle you and force you to kind of reassess everything about your life and which way it's going. I emailed him a condolence email when I heard about his dad, but I'm sorry to hear about both episodes that happened to him. So I can totally understand why he's made this decision. But I will miss the In the Rabbit Hole podcasts. And I think the survivalist world is kind of lacking, I'm generalizing here, of course, but I think the survivalist world is generally lacking in a lot of the qualities that Aaron Frankel has. Not only good humor in his podcast, but also good information and friendly and not pretentious. And at the same time, he's very smart. Just to listen to him talk, you can tell that he's up there in the brain department. But yet he's approachable. So it's a good combination. And I'll miss his episodes at In the Rabbit Hole. He's also a gun nut. And in his typical way, he kind of jokes about that as well. He just, you know, in his writings, he'll talk about guns and then he'll say, because guns, you know, just it's understood. He's just, you know, he likes guns. And so that's the end of it. You know? So I like that. And also, there's a little bit of history between him and me. Before I started Survival in Motion podcast, I reached out to him about just the details, the nuts and bolts of it all. And he was extremely helpful and went out of his way to be very, very informative and instructive on how to set up this podcast. So I still feel indebted to him, and I really appreciate that. Apparently, Aaron Frankel will still go on and produce content on his YouTube channel, and In the Rabbit Hole at YouTube is something that we should all check out from time to time and subscribe to and give a thumbs up to and give reviews for. Anyway, this podcast I'm recording today will end with kind of a sappy song, but it's not that I'm sad that Aaron Frankel is leaving the content producing scene in the survivalist world. I'm more like encouraging. I want to encourage him to stay active and to stay in the situation where he's producing content for those of us who really appreciate it. So anyway, that's going to be my interview with Aaron Frankel. Let me switch gears here and talk a little bit about my book happenings and the latest news. My book, EMP NYC, which stands for Electromagnetic Pulse New York City, is available in ebook format and also on paperback. And it's for sale right now on Amazon exclusive. That will not always be the case. The audio version of the book is coming. That's something I'm putting together through Find Away Voices. Also, I finally got a review on Amazon. It was a 4-star review, but I'll take it. The review was very complimentary of the book, and it concluded by saying highly recommended. So I'm happy about that review. I know there are several reviews of this book on Goodreads, so check out those reviews. Anyway, I covet reviews for this book. So please, if I'd consider it a real favor, if you, whether it's Amazon or Goodreads or wherever, at some point this will be distributed outside of Amazon. But I sure could use some more reviews for this book. A friend of mine, former church elder, read the book, and he said in the span of 2 days he was not able to put it down. He said there were a lot of unexpected scenes and content in the book. So he said he really enjoyed it. Like I said, he could not put the book down except for sleeping and eating and going to work. He then said, you should consider getting some therapy, which I'll take that as a compliment. I'm also now working on the sequel to that book, and part of it is taking place in London. Kind of a funny story. About a year ago, some family was visiting, and the subject of the play Hamilton came up, and I have not seen that play. And somebody made a comment that, oh yeah, the author or the music creator or whatever of that play grew up in this neighborhood in New York City, and you know, that's in Harlem. And I pulled out my laminated New York City map, and I said, oh, actually, that neighborhood is over here. It's not in Harlem. So the question came up, what are you doing walking around with a laminated map of New York City? And I said, you know, I'm blowing up half that town in my book, so I need to know where everything is. So we had a good laugh. Anyway, now that I'm working on the sequel, and the sequel book, part of it takes place in London, my wife recently got me a laminated map of London, along with an A to Z, so-called, as they say it. But, you know, London is going to fare a little bit better in my book than New York City did. But anyway, I thought that was kind of funny. All right, almost back to Aaron Frankel. All right, big news regarding the first EMP book that I wrote a couple years ago. It's entitled EMP, The End of the Grid as We Know It. The ebook version of that book will be free on Amazon on June 6th through 11th. Again, this is a free ebook. If you have a Kindle device or if you have the Kindle app on your iPhone, on these dates, June 6th to June 11th, go over to Amazon and download that book for free. And all I request, and this is not a condition necessarily, but I'd request that you download the book, that you read the book, and that you leave a review for that book as well. In fact, all my books need reviews. I mean, the sales are good, and the people I've talked to who have read them like the books, but it could use some more reviews, definitely, wherever, you know. All right, back to Aaron Frankel. At one point, you'll hear in the discussion, he and I talk about the need to discuss on survivalist podcasts the smaller disasters that are more likely to have happen, even though they're less glamorous. And they might involve fewer guns. Well, that's my commentary. But he and I were talking about, yeah, that's important too. Instead of concentrating so much on the end of the world, it's a good idea to prepare for the smaller things that you, the listener, will probably more likely have happened to you in the next 2 or 3 weeks. I'm talking about a flood or a fire, hurricane, earthquake, whatever. And along those lines, I have a couple of minor disasters and how I handle them I'd like to share with you. First is, it's been a project of mine lately to clean up a lot of junk on my vacant property. And I'm reminded of that chapter in my other book, which is a nonfiction book, Dirt Cheap, Valuable Survival Retreat. Towards the end of that book, I had a chapter that said, basically, beware of friends bearing junk. And I wish I had paid more attention to my own advice than I apparently did, because on my property, it's a vacant piece of property, many acres, but there's a lot of junk that has been left there by friends. And it's been a project of mine to load up my covered trailer and drive it into the city dump, maybe once a week, maybe once every other week. Anyway, all right, here's what I'm leading up to. There was a pile of trash inside the trailer, and I was kind of throwing in frisbee fashion some more trash, and I wanted to have that trash kind of clear the pile of trash inside the trailer, but yet not hit the ceiling. So I kind of frisbee threw some trash in there. And then my arm kind of hit some metal that I was also throwing away. And right away, I looked at the metal and I thought, oh, great. There's a little bit of rust there. Blood came gushing out of my arm. It was pretty bad. So I went inside the house and took some paper towels and pressed on it real firmly for a few minutes and stopped the bleeding. Cleaned the area just with some foam soap, and then I put some antibiotic ointment and a Band-Aid. And I kept it on there. I changed Band-Aids, but I did that consistently for 2 weeks, and it finally healed. For a while there, I was wondering if I might need stitches or something. It was a real gusher. Anyway, two things I wanted to point out. Number one, antibiotic ointment helps cuts heal a lot faster. So I'm glad I had some of that handy. Secondly is, right after this happened and after I stopped the bleeding, I went on the computer to check the last time that I had had a tetanus shot. And that was 10 and a half years earlier. So from what I know of tetanus, I don't know that much about it, but I know it can result in locked jaw and some really painful muscle spasms. And 10% of the time, it's fatal. So I didn't want to take any chances. So as I understand, tetanus shots, they're effective for 10 years. And by the way, it's not just rust. It's any kind of open wound where some kind of a bacterium gets in and it can cause you to get tetanus. Okay. I didn't want to take any chances. So later on that day, I went into the local Walmart and paid $60 and got a tetanus shot right then and there. So I'm glad I had that done. So if you're not up to date with a tetanus shot, it might be a good idea to go in and just a local Walmart and just pay $60 for one instead of waiting like I did until you get a bad cut. And then you realize, oops, you know, it's 10 and a half years old. So I got a new tetanus shot and it'll last another 10 years, supposedly. All right. Here's another example of a smaller disaster that is more likely to happen every day. And this is something that we should all prepare for. And I'm talking about an incident that I went through a few weeks ago of road rage. There was no physical attack, but I'd say it was kind of a DEFCON 3, maybe a DEFCON 2 level incident. It was looking pretty imminent there for a while. All right, here's what happened. I was driving home from work, stuck in traffic on an interstate, and it was just totally packed with cars, bumper to bumper. I was in the number 5 lane. I saw the number 4 lane open up and start driving a lot faster than my lane. So I thought there was an opening. I changed lanes, and then this car behind me started honking. And no kidding, it was like 2 minutes straight. And I just, you know, nodded my head. No, I did not flip the guy off, much as I was tempted to, but it did not do anything like that. And I looked in my rear view, and somehow his windshield at the top of it, you know, he must have reversed the lettering or something, so I could read it in my rearview mirror. It said, get off the road or get out of my way or something like that. So anyway, then, you know, the stop and go traffic happened. He pulled up right next to me and then both lanes stopped. And I was just nodding no. And he threw something in front of my car. And then his lane opened up and he went off. And after a while, I started noticing other cars had pulled off onto the shoulder. And he was not just honking at me and telling me to get off the road. He was doing that to everybody. And here's the deal. I have a concealed handgun license. The gun is within reach. I also have a can of pepper spray. That's what I reached for first. I didn't want this to escalate to a deadly incident if I could just grab pepper spray first. If he did come at me with a gun, I would have grabbed my gun. But I had pepper spray ready to go, and I was almost hoping that he would get out of his car and come towards my car so I could hose his face down with some pepper spray, but I didn't. Anyway, the weirdest thing, he came up behind me again, which means I guess he drove up ahead. A bunch of people drove off onto the shoulder. I guess he was honking at them. And then he must have exited and then got back on and resumed his honking at everybody. So I thought, well, if he's just harassing everybody else on the road, let me at least get a picture of the guy so I can phone it in to the cops with a license plate. So the guy wound up behind me again, and he was honking for at least 2 minutes straight. So then he pulls up next to me, and I'm trying to get a photo of him with my phone. And he sees that I've got my iPhone pointed at him, and he just speeds away. So the bottom line here is, I had my gun ready if needed. I was not reaching for that at the time. I did have my pepper spray ready, but that never was needed. But here's the point. If nothing else, if you find yourself in this situation where it's a road rage situation and you feel like, okay, physical contact is imminent, at least pull up your phone and act like you're taking a video of the perpetrator. And you never know. Like in my situation, you know, I never got a clear photo of the guy, but at least he saw me holding up my phone pointed at him and he sped off. And that was the last I saw of him that whole day. So he must have exited the highway and skedaddled. Anyway, that's another example of a minor disaster that is more likely to have happened. I think it's good advice. Just hold up your phone. You never know if that might be something that will dissuade a road rager from physical contact with you. Anyway, let me get on with my interview of In the Rabbit Hole podcaster, Aaron Frankel. Enjoy. And now, the survival show that once survived listening to the ITRH WTF episode, but got bummed. Aaron Frankel, podcaster at In the Rabbit Hole podcast. Welcome to the Survival in Motion podcast, dude.
Absolutely my pleasure. And I got to say, I was bummed making that episode. It was not fun to do. I agonized over it for quite a while before I actually made it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, I can't remember what blog I was at, but I just saw a whole bunch of comments somewhere just saying, oh, this is too bad. This is terrible. You know, go listen to that. And I thought, oh, no. Oh, no. And sure enough, I went and listened to it. You know, I'm sure a lot of preppers are bummed about it.
Well, I don't want them to be bummed, but I'm sure they are. And it's interesting. I mean, I've gotten a little bit of feedback. Most of it's been very positive and fairly understanding of the basic reasons I've given for why I'm doing it. But yeah, it's sad. It's been a huge part of my life for 8 years now, I think, or a little over 8 years, something like that.
Well, I totally understand. When you went down the reasons for it, I can totally understand. But sad to see it go. Anyway, you still have a couple episodes left, right?
That is correct. I think there are four episodes left in total. There's another one that's going to essentially be a monologue, two interviews that I'm still working on, and then the actual finale itself, where one of the listeners is going to sit and interview me. And it's going to be a surprise. I don't know what it's going to all be about. But, it should be interesting.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of the final episode of Johnny Carson had. As I recall, like Bette Midler showed up and sang to him. And
oh, fun.
Anyway, you said 8 years you've been doing that podcast?
Yeah, it's been about 8 years, maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah, you had a co-host with you at one point, right?
Yeah, the show went through two co-hosts. First, there was Jonathan. And Jason was the other co-host who came on a little bit after that. Jason was still in the mix, and Jason and I were... He was part of our group, and we were doing a lot of projects together, and we kind of realized in the beginning that having three people talking all at once was too much, and Jonathan was more well-versed in politics and law and things like that, and then Jonathan's life got busy. He got married, had a kid, and so then Jason came in for a while, and then he did the same thing, got married, had a kid, and then it was just a one-man band for a little while.
Yeah, I think it's Jason I remember, but I'm sure they were both good. How'd you get started with prepping and in the rabbit hole?
Prepping, for me, that started about 15 or 16 years ago. And in general, it was, somebody asked me this the other day, and I was really trying to think back. It's been a while now. There were some professional things that were going on. I was involved with some projects, and those projects had, I don't mean to be Mr. Mysterio, but it was, those projects had some security connotations to them, and it kind of freaked me out. And so that helped me realize just how fragile things can be working on that project. And then I'd also been in architecture and dealt a lot with security as it applies to architecture and facilities. And I think that had always kept me a little more aware than I think of most people of how fragile different systems are and how fragile the electric grid is and things like that. And then about 15 or 16 years ago, a lot of it was just the politics and things going on and the divide in the country and the mistrust between people in general. And I just started to get a very bad feeling about things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember we're talking like the mid-2000s, right?
Yeah, sort of early 2000s.
Well, I remember at that time thinking, you know, wow, I thought Reagan was hated, you know, and then George W. Bush was, I've never seen hatred like that. And then, of course, it's now been eclipsed even by that, you know. But yeah, I remember those days kind of like, wow, there's like no limit to the hatred out there and just the resentment. And so I guess that, yeah, that would be a good time to get started. I guess you weren't moved by the Y2K scare?
You know, I think like most people, I was moved by it. I wasn't moved to become as serious about it as I did a few years later. I didn't see it as big of a threat as a lot of people did. I worked with a number of different computer systems and understood that those computers, that the issue was not as widespread as a lot of the media was making it out to be. I was a little worried about it, you know, had a little bit of beans, bullets, and band-aids on hand, but it was not, yeah, you know, full-blown prepper time for me at that point.
Yeah, I remember at the time, you know, hearing the scare stories and kind of following along and just thinking, well, that would be pretty bummed. But then I remember thinking at the time, you know, every time I call in for a credit card balance, the story I get was our computers are down. And mm-hmm. I just remember thinking, well, if computers are down, they're down all the time anyway. So that's when I kind of backed off on the whole Y2K thing. Mm-hmm. But I think I was kind of a, well, of course, we didn't call it a prepper back then, but I was kind of mildly survival-minded at the time. It was a few years later, I just thought, whoa, things are going way off in the wrong direction, you know?
Yeah, so was it the same thing for you? It was just kind of like a general sense of, the world is going in a strange direction here.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And just thinking, this can't last. I mean, to this day, I'm still kind of surprised that, you know, it hasn't happened already, but yeah, I still felt like we're going off in the wrong direction here, you know?
Yeah. I've calmed down quite a bit over the few years, but that's something that I definitely see. It continues to get worse, and it'll be curious to see how that resolves itself.
Mm-hmm. Now, the timing, though, you know, the last couple of years, it seems like there's a lull in the amperage of the prepping world. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. I've seen that, and I know a lot of people have seen that. And it's interesting, too, because I know a lot of prepper-related businesses have sort of gone under in the last 2 years. What I think in a lot of ways has happened is that with Obama, a lot of conservative, right side of the aisle people came into preparedness. I mean, that guns and preparedness, the whole industry was just went bananas as soon as Obama came into office. And I think the disposition of a lot of conservatives and libertarians is already that sense of self-reliance anyway. And so there's a propensity towards survival and preparedness to begin with. And then I think as we've seen Trump come into office, and this is a cycle, I've seen it happen a bunch of times where their guy is in office and all of a sudden they feel safe. And then their guy's out of office and, you know, the next person is from the opposing side and they're the boogeyman and the world's going to end. And so they get revved up. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what's going on right now is it's actually, I would say, the left more liberal, not classically. I don't want to start splitting hairs about those things, but just what people think of as liberal. There's been a huge influx of liberals into survival and preparedness, worried about Trump for the exact same reasons people were worried about Obama. And comically enough, if you listen to the things they talk about and list the things they say, the only thing you'd have to do would be transpose Obama for Trump.
Yeah.
And it's the exact same stuff all over again. And then the other thing I've noticed is, of course, since most of the community, the older aspects of the community, the parts of the community that have been around for a while, those parts of the community are conservative libertarian. And so as liberals come in, they're like, well, I don't like this guy's message and I'm just not going to listen to him. So a lot of the more traditional side of the preparedness and survival community feels this lull in things because our side, you know, is not feeling the tension and we're also not seeing the numbers that we used to in a lot of ways. You know, I know my podcast download numbers, they didn't go down, but they definitely hit a plateau right around the time that Trump came in. And then I saw a little bit of a bump, but anything else. But another interesting thing that started to happen was, you know, I would get the occasional negative comment on iTunes. Eh, fine, whatever. Some of them are funny. Some of them are dumb. Some of them are actually helpful. I think somebody said something one time and it was a terrible comment. But I was like, you know, actually, I think he's right. And I made some changes to the show. But no one was really complaining about my politics. And I don't make a big thing of my politics on the show, but I do put it into the show when I think it is appropriate for the subject matter or explains something. And I started all of a sudden seeing comments about people not liking my politics, or they would say, oh, I wish you would just shut up and talk about preparedness. I don't want to hear about his politics, or leave his politics out of it. And I'm like, well, what I'm talking about is more philosophical than it is politics.
Mm-hmm.
But I understood their point, but it was like, well, it's a free show. Listen, don't listen, skip the episode, do what you want. But I think more to the point, all of a sudden I saw an uptick in something that I'd never really seen before. And I think that was because it was an influx from the other. You know, I definitely feel that lull that everybody else does too. And I think those people are just going somewhere else for their information and stuff.
Yeah, a few episodes ago, I had an interview with author Angry American.
Mm-hmm.
And he made the point, and it kind of stumped me at the time, that the prepper world, quote unquote, is now being made up of a lot of millennials coming in.
Yeah.
Which really surprised me, because I think of prepping, you know, just the prepping world as kind of you look out on the landscape and you don't feel right about what you see. Whereas I think millennials, they look out and everything's on their side. I mean, and this, of course, getting political, but the news, you know, academia, entertainment even. You go to a movie and there's just straight out left, you know, constant left messages everywhere you look. The news, everything is, I think, on their side. And it's kind of hard to look out in society, in the culture, and feel like there's something going on that's wrong, you know, aside from the guy in the Oval Office. And
you know, I'm spending a lot of time at a university right now, and it's interesting in that it's like anything in life. It's easy to make a caricature of a group or a generation.
I'm painting with a broad brush, definitely. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, I mean, I'm Gen X, and I remember, you know, we were the slacker generation and this and that. And that was true to an extent, and in some ways we grew out of it. But I think with the millennials, I'm seeing a few different things. There was a lot of stuff they didn't get from their Gen X parents as far as how to live, how to be self-sufficient. And I think then they've gone out into the world and gone, wow, the world is not a safe space, and it can be a scary place. And then there are also, they grew up in the financial crash that we all remember, and so that's their perspective too. So I think there are a lot more of them that are into this than I think people would think. I definitely understand the millennial that we all caricature.
Mm-hmm.
I've certainly met plenty of them, and some of them you just wonder, wow, okay. But others, you're like, okay, if you just kind of nudge you in this direction over here, you'd be on your path. And then I see, like, papers getting written and comments being made in different academic things. I'm like, okay, there's some smart kids out there that get it. They just aren't aware that all this stuff has already been thought of before.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said a few minutes ago about before Trump getting elected, there was a lot of excitement in the prepping world. I'll never forget that San Bernardino shooting. And then President Obama came on the TV and talked about gun control and I think climate change. And I remember the next day just thinking, well, I'll just mosey on over to the gun store and pick up some bullets. It was packed. The local gun store was packed. And I think guns were just flying off the shelves.
Yeah, I think the joke in the firearms world was that Obama was their best salesman ever.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, the same thing was said about Clinton when Clinton was in office.
Yeah, that's true.
But, you know, I fell victim to a little bit of it, too. I mean, every time they'd say something, I'd be like, well, maybe I need to order another case, something.
And that's right.
You know, I think there was a funny thing. I was chatting back and forth with another friend, and something came up, and he was like, all right, well, I think I'm set this time around. And I'm like, oh, what'd you just do? And he's like, I just ordered 350 pounds of ammo. And I was just like, what?
Yeah.
And this is somebody was already well equipped to begin with. But yeah, I mean, we all fell victim to it.
Sure.
In one way or another. But yeah, gosh, it was pretty crazy to watch that stuff with Obama.
I know. Well, I plead guilty myself to that too. Yeah, that the urgency What's your feeling on what would be the most likely SHTF scenario, or plural, likeliest scenarios? What's your feeling?
Well, I guess to start with, I've always had a sense of more of cascading failures.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever I've looked at any complex system, anytime you see a complex system fail, it's usually something people should have expected. And generally the people boots on the ground deal with it every day. We're like, oh yeah, we totally saw how that was going to happen. And then it leads to a cascading failure. You know, we've seen this lots of times in the electric grid. Somebody's tree limb hits a power line, and then somehow an entire region goes black, which I think actually did happen a couple of years ago in the Northeast. Yeah. And so for me, I would see things going down that same way. It'll be one thing. It'll probably be one of the things that people kind of expect, at least preppers kind of expect. But then it's going to be a cascade of just crap. For me personally, the things that I worry about are economic. I think our economic system, I mean, this isn't new, but our economic system is statistically kind of due for a crash. And I think the other thing, too, is we never actually cleared out the detritus of the problems and underlying issues that were going on with the crash of 2008. We're still making stupid loans. Those loans are being done just in a different area. Rather than housing, it's, you know, being done in school loans and car loans. And we're starting to see some kind of funky things happen where I think we're seeing a spike in car loan defaults and student loan defaults that are a little troubling. But I'm not saying that's going to happen tomorrow. I'm just saying that these are the kinds of things that I tend to keep my ear to the ground about. So economic is one. I would say my more far-fetched would be a grid hack. I'm not a big EMP guy. I was concerned about it for a little while, and I thought, wow, okay, this is pretty serious stuff. But over the years, I've come to look at that a little bit more as I don't really see the proper motivation or the value to a bad actor to do that. And then also, it's not just let's get a nuclear warhead and launch it over the country. Like, the logistics are not simple per se. They sound simple, but they're really not. But what I do worry about is everything's computerized now, which, you know, it makes our lives pretty wonderful in a lot of ways. But it also makes us very susceptible. And we've had a number of world leaders, one in particular, I think it was Putin, that said the next war will be fought with ones and zeros, not tanks and bombs.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to it. And if you want to gain leverage over society for whatever your end goal is, destroying them outright is not really productive. But if you could hold them hostage, you know, by taking control of their power grid or something, that to me would make more sense. Like, everybody talks about North Korea, and I think in a lot of ways North Korea is, I kind of look at him and like Dr. Evil, you know, it's like, yeah, he's more just trying to make a ruckus, and he wants $1 billion more than he actually wants to destroy things. And so I would see them doing something like, to them it would make more sense to hold us hostage and to gain leverage over us than it would just be to wipe us off the face of the earth. Because if you look at any of the actors or nations around the world that really have the capability to pull something like that off, the world is pretty tightly netted together. And if we go down, kind of everybody goes down with us.
Yeah, you kind of need to keep the golden goose alive, you know?
Yeah. Now, that being said, you know, I think an EMP in general is just a horrifying possibility, and certainly a possibility. But my big two are economic and then grid hack.
Yeah, the debt scenario, I keep hearing that we're getting closer and closer to the point where more and more of our annual budget goes to just pay interest on the debt. You know, and the problem with something going wrong there is that it's almost like there's no coming back. You know, there would be some kind of hyperinflation. The value of the dollar, I think, would plummet, you know, just to pay off all the debt. And then interest rates would go way up as well, you know, because that's the only way to, you can sell a bond to anybody that would be interested in it. So, I mean, yeah, that would be pretty ugly. And I don't see any coming back from that.
Yeah, it's certainly not a fast recovery. There have been some instances in history where nations have crashed financially and gone into business. And within a few years, they bounced back. But those were in times when, A, smaller nations, B, smaller dollar figures, and the world wasn't so chained together like a bunch of mountain climbers, which in one respect is good, and the other respect is bad because, well, if we tank, the whole world's economy goes just bananas.
Yeah, as far as EMP and the grid goes, I remember back maybe junior high school, I had a good friend of mine who subscribed as a Soldier of Fortune, you know, And as we grew up, you know, he went off and I think joined the Navy, and I went off and did my thing. And here's what kind of got me going about EMP. I was thinking about buying this old pickup truck, you know, with all the mechanical parts and almost nothing electronic. And I emailed my friend, this is like 20, 25 years later, and I said, hey, you think this is the type of vehicle that would survive an EMP? And the email came back and he said, what's an EMP? And I thought, whoa, hold on. This guy was a prepper when he was a little kid. And so I thought, who knows? Maybe it's just not something that anybody pays attention to. And they probably should. I mean, that's kind of what got me going about EMP. As well as that, I think it was 2012 when I think we missed a coronal mass ejection by like 2 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. Did you read about that? I think it was 2012, but don't hold me on that.
Yeah, no, I remember the event. I don't remember the exact date, but yeah, and a coronal mass ejection can, even more than just an EMP, depending on the size, can do just as much damage as an EMP. They're definitely very scary, and there was a time I was very concerned about it. I think it's one of those things that I finally came to look at and just said, I think that's a bigger problem that I'm willing to try to get my arms around.
Sure. I mean, statistically, let's face it. Mm-hmm. The more likely stuff is the smaller stuff, you know, the flooding, the hurricane, the wildfire, that kind of thing. That happens all the time. Yep. So might as well get prepared for that first, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, what got you started with guns?
Guns, actually, that's been a long time thing. I grew up around guns. I wouldn't say like avid shooters, but we were definitely shooters. And my grandfather was a Marine, fought in two wars, and felt it very important for all of his family to know how to shoot and stuff. And I got a little bit of that when I was a kid. And then I just always found them interesting. I don't know. I was just a boy, I guess, and thought, wow, these, you know, smoke and noise sounds like fun. Then when I was 18, I bought my first shotgun. And then when I was 21, I, you know, bought my first pistol and went and got my concealed handgun license as soon as that came out, which was about the same time.
Cool.
And then I just got more and more into it. And then, you know, definitely as I got into, I was never a big rifle guy and never really big into ARs and stuff like that. And the tactical stuff, to me, it was more of just a simple pistols and shotgun kind of thing when I was younger. And then as I started getting into preparedness, it became more about rifles and more tactical shooting and things like that. And then it just ballooned. And next thing I knew, I had a big gun safe and all the other, you know, shenanigans.
Mm-hmm. You bring it up a lot in the rabbit hole. Do you have any advice you would give to anybody who occasionally I get emails, you know, where do I even start, you know?
Well, I think the simplest place to start is to go to a gun range and rent a pistol. And if they'll let you, rent a shotgun and start there and see what you like. And then the next thing is just take a basic class on either one. I generally steer people away from any of the, you know, high energy, shoot them in the face kind of tactical classes, especially for a while. Those are fun, but I think just getting started, they're not necessary and they're a bit much, especially the older I get, the much more I'm into, just learn the basics. And I think that's it. And I give the same advice when people are like, how do I choose the right gun? And go to the gun range, rent a bunch of them and figure out what you like and then try it out. It won't be your last gun. And I think that's the thing of it, too. I mean, it's like a lot of things. It's people want to buy once and cry once. But I don't know that that's possible, especially if you're going to use it often. Because one of the things I find is the more I use a particular weapon, tool, I mean, it doesn't even matter if it's any kind of tool, the more intimately I'm experienced with it and understand it and then gain a better understanding of what I like and what I don't like and what I would rather have and things like that. And so it evolves and you sell them or you just get more or and you evolve over time. But I think the simplest thing to do is just go rent something, give it a try, go to a very basic class. Even the NRA classes are pretty decent for just getting a start. They're not very exciting, which is okay, but that's where people should start, not with the rolling around in the dirt and shooting from prone and all these other whiz bang magpul video things.
Yep. That's how I started. I just found a gun store on the way to work and I just kind of went in and just asked a few questions. And I guess you kind of have to walk in with the understanding that, hey, I'm just here to ask some dumb questions and to kind of educate myself, you know? And surprisingly, the guys were pretty cool.
That is unusual for a gun shop. Sure I'm going to get some hate on that from some gun shop. When I find a good gun shop and the guys behind the counter aren't there to impress themselves, they're there to actually service the customers, man, I hang on to that story as long as I can. But yeah, that's pretty good. I think both of my first guns, I got some advice on my second gun. My first gun, I really didn't. I just walked in the store. I was like, oh, I'm 18. It's Texas. I can get a shotgun. Let me get a shotgun. And ooh, that one looks cool. Let me get that one. And then the second one, I studied up on pistols and studied up on calibers and all these whiz-bang things. And then I was in the store, and this old grizzled cop gave me some advice, and we talked for a little bit, and he gave me some advice, and I completely ignored him, and it's funny because I think it was about 20 years later I circled back and did exactly what he said to do.
Well, that's what young people do, you know.
Which was just, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's the thing. Everybody wants to go into a store and feel like they're knowledgeable and feel like they know what they're doing, and it's like, well, if it's your first gun, just like you did, I mean, that's the perfectly healthy thing and proper thing to do, which is to go in and say, I don't know nothing about nothing. And this is my first one, so what's the right thing to do here?
Yeah. All right. As far as In the Rabbit Hole, you've had almost 300 episodes, right?
Yep, coming up on 300.
Okay. Aside from the times when I was a guest on In the Rabbit Hole, what would you say were the most memorable moments at In the Rabbit Hole?
Well, you know, if I can't include you in that.
Yeah,
Everything else comes in a pretty far second. The first episode. The first episode was just, God, we didn't know what we didn't know. And we were just a couple of crazy guys thinking we could do something better than somebody else was doing. And just having a good time with it. And I'm just being so nervous, like, oh, my God, we're going to put this out there and people are going to hate us.
And that sounds familiar.
Yeah, every podcaster ever. We were just convinced, like, oh, my God, this is going to get downloaded, like, 10 times, and all 10 people are going to send us a message about how much they hate us and how we're terrible and don't know what we're talking about. And the response was quite the opposite. We got there's a whole bunch of downloads and got a few nice messages from people, by the way, like comments and stuff on iTunes and stuff. I would say the next most memorable time, and it was also, like, one of the hardest. And it was both when Jonathan had to leave the show and then again when Jason had to leave the show. Those were the hardest for two reasons. One, I mean, those were my buds. Those were, you know, I think Jason and I have been friends for, almost 25 years now. And Jonathan and I have been friends for probably about 18 years. And we're always so close and did so many things together. And then to not be engaged in that project together anymore was difficult. But also the really difficult part of the show was two guys doing silly stuff, and it had to do with survival. And then for it to be one guy, that was tricky because, like, the whole show completely changed. It was a rough period trying to get used to doing it by myself and not having a partner in crime to talk to. So I would say those were the most memorable. And I would say then, of course, the other one was making that decision to end the show. That was hard. And that decision actually took me about a year to make. And then it was like the final decision. It took me about 4 or 5 months to really come to terms with doing it.
Hmm. Well, as a listener and a fan of your podcast, I can say I did enjoy both the prepping information and the guests you had, and also the fact that you and Jason or whoever, or you alone, didn't take yourself too seriously. And there was always a chance for humor. And I could tell that your lack of self-importance, you know what I mean, it came through. And it was an enjoyable episode. Well, it still is for the next several, you know?
Mm-hmm. When we were originally developing the show, that was one of the key differences that we wanted in the show. And I think part of that was born out of we didn't and still don't think we're experts. And we say, okay, well, how do we speak about this and share what we know, but also convey the fact that we're not experts and we're on this journey and we're sharing what we already know. We're sharing what we've done wrong and how we ended up fixing it later, but then also the journey going forward of how are we going to be better? How are we going to learn more?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That you're speaking from the point of view of somebody else who is also learning this stuff, not claiming to be an expert. I think that's great. In fact, that's what I try to do on my show here.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as difficult as it was to listen to that episode, the WTF episode, you made your case. I mean, I know as running this podcast, it's definitely a money loser, but it's, you know, I can say it's fun. I mean, I enjoy kicking around the ideas, you know, and then there's the, the Christmas episodes too. Those are fun.
Yeah. Your Christmas episodes are good.
Thanks.
Yeah. I think that I will definitely miss making the show for a couple of reasons. One, I mean, I love the listeners and I love making the show and I love doing it and I love just the craft. I get really into microphones and playing around with things and trying to figure out how to make the show better, not just the sound, but just the presentation and everything else. And then when I started doing the video, like, got really into understanding video and color correction and color grading and all these other things and just having fun with it. But it definitely, yeah, it's financially, it takes a toll. But it, I mean, for me, the biggest one was really just time. Just the time and the how many hours I have in a week and how much time it takes to make a single episode.
Yeah.
To make a good one. I could make a really bad one very easily.
Yeah, but, same here, yeah.
But as you said, to sit and take an idea, well, first to run through a list of ideas and figure out, like, okay, how can I actually talk about what do people need to hear? How can I help people? Like, what one thing can I talk about that I think will help? And then to take that idea and to chew on it for a while and make it formal. And in a lot of ways, I get as much out of it, I think, or hope, as the audience does, because it's forced me to really formalize how I feel or how I think about something a lot of times. Because, you know, we all have stuff that rattles around in our brain and we have the unconscious knowledge. But to take that unconscious knowledge that rattles around from years of experience, but then to make it into something where we clearly explain it to somebody else.
Yeah.
That helped me a lot. I mean, just personally in the way that I look at things and the way I conduct my own life.
Well, I should tell the listeners that I think it was about 6 months before I started Survival in Motion that you and I emailed back and forth. And then I think at one point you and I talked on the phone about how to set up a podcast. And I still appreciate that. But you made the point that I'll still remember, which is the technical side of this is important. In other words, it's got to be clear and crisp and well edited and that kind of thing. But the main thing is the content has to be just out of the park. You know, it's got to be really good. It's got to be informational. It's got to be conversational, you know, because I think a lot of this is people just like hearing, you know, a couple people talk back and forth.
Yeah, definitely. I think if anybody ever, you know, if anybody listening wanted to start a podcast, and I actually do talk to a lot of people that are doing podcasts, and my biggest advice is always get a basic setup, but it's just like guns. Don't go overboard. People will forgive mediocre audio, and in some cases they'll even forgive bad audio if the content is really great. If you really feel like you can connect with the host, and if you feel like you're being entertained, and if you feel like you also really got something out of it, that's what really matters. And I think with podcasting, it's like anything. It's so easy to get caught up in the minutiae and the details. I mean, I still do it. Like I was just talking about a minute ago, playing with video. I got all down the rabbit hole of the technical aspects of doing video.
Yep.
And it was, you know, trying to always keep my eye on the ball with, like, okay, that's cool. It looks cool, but I still got to try to make it as entertaining as possible.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's interesting. It's tricky to do right. I don't feel like I've ever actually gotten it right, but yeah.
Oh, you know, as a fan, I was happy. I was looking forward to your episodes every week, you know.
Thanks.
All right, I got to ask, after the 300th episode of In the Rabbit Hole, and you finally unplug everything and probably clear away that desk in your house there that I've seen, and what's the future for Aaron Frankel?
So I guess there's a few interesting things, and the desk has already been cleared off. It's not so much cleared off as reorganized to accommodate for different things going on. Basically, all the equipment is going to stay set up and everything, and I'll circle back to that in a second and leave everybody hanging. For me personally, it's going to be more about spending some much needed time with my wife, who does not get as much attention as she's due. And then hopefully we'll have kids coming along soon and time spent with them. And then also just taking care of some personal things in my life. You know, I'm in my early 40s and just life kind of changes a little bit in your early 40s and you get a different perspective. And then I had some life events that really did change my perspective on a few things. And so just where I'm going with my life and what I'm doing, I need to spend some time focusing on, and then doing a bit of stuff to circle back to an old project in academia that I put on hold a long time ago. So that's it in a nutshell. As far as unplugging the rabbit hole, like, I'm not going to just turn it off. I'll leave the feed up on iTunes and on YouTube and everything indefinitely. I have made mention a few times that any new stuff will mostly go on YouTube. And I guess so that people will understand, like, I love podcasting. I have so much fun doing it. I really do. And I'm so thankful to Apple, who really spearheaded at the beginning, no real benefit to them, spearheaded and made podcasting possible. But podcasting to me is just a medium for long form content that is consumed rather passively. You listen to it on the go, you listen to it in your car, bus, whatever. And I think for me, I just don't have the time to produce that long form content. And I also don't want to be married to a schedule of making stuff. So I would rather make short form content. I would also like to do more instructional stuff. And instructional stuff just does better with visuals. So most of the new stuff I'll be doing on YouTube. And I've said to a few here and there that, like I said, I won't turn off the feed. I don't have any plans to ever release a new episode, but I'm certainly leaving the door open that if I think of something that I feel is important to say and important to be heard, then I'll put it out. But that'll be about it. Other than that, I'm going to let other people carry the community torch and have their time.
So we'll be watching for future YouTube episodes, right?
Yeah.
How about any blogging or any kind of writing or anything?
No, I have to do so much writing in my day job right now and also with the academic project that I'm working on that I don't really see myself doing a whole lot of writing or blogging in the future. I've been asked to work on a couple of books with different people, some in the field, some in other fields. So I've got a lot of irons in the fire already, and so I don't think I'll be doing a lot of writing. At least in the survival community.
Okay. Well, let me make this offer, and it's just something to think about and don't need an answer right now. But I've done several books self-published, and I know there's kind of a trick to it here and there, and I'd be happy to help you out, like you helped me out getting this podcast going. So
that would be awesome.
If you ever feel the urge, let me know.
It's funny. I often get the urge to write a book. I often get the urge. There's a few different books that I would like to write. But it's funny, I've spent so much time with authors and working on the marketing for authors that that every time I think of writing a book, I'm like, yeah, you remember that time and you were working with Neil on that book and everybody was screaming for like 6 months straight. And
yeah.
Then there were the crazy hours of research and so I talked myself out of it. But I may take you up on your offer one day. I greatly appreciate it.
Well, you never know. Okay. Well, yeah. Anyway, I know I've taken up enough of your day here today. I sure appreciate you joining me.
Always happy to.
And Aaron Frankel of In the Rabbit Hole podcast, thanks again for joining me and all the best.
Thanks for having me on, dude.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse. Nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse.
How lovely it was. Thanks for the memory of Schubert's serenade, little things of jade, and traffic jams and anagrams and bills we never paid.
How lovely it was. We who could laugh over big things were parted by only a slight thing.
I wonder if we did the right thing. Oh, well, that's life, I guess.
I love your dress.
Do you?
It's pretty.
Thanks for the memory of faults that you forgave, rainbows on a wave,
and stockings in the basin when a fellow needs a shave. Thank you so much.